This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Yesterday, there was a memorial service for internet activist Aaron Swartz, who took his life last week. In 2011, he was indicted on federal charges of illegally downloading 4.8 million articles and documents. Charges in the case, including wire fraud and computer fraud, were pending at the time of his death, carrying potential penalties of up to 35 years in prison and $1 million in fines. And joining me in Studio 3 is Bettina Neufeind. She knew Aaron well, and she was helping to raise money for his legal defense. Bettina Neufeind, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let me ask you a little bit about the funeral. Aaron Swartz's father said at the funeral that he was killed by the government. I wonder, you know, were you surprised that that kind of language was used? I mean, obviously, this is somebody who's really upset.
I was not surprised that that language was used, partly because Aaron's parents and his partner had released a statement several days immediately following Aaron's death, stating that they believed that the overzealous prosecution of Aaron had played a substantial part in his suicide. Numerous other people who knew Aaron well and who knew the situation well had also been very public in voicing their belief that that had been a really dominant factor.
Do you think that his parents, the people who knew him well, had seen the toll that this case had taken on him? Did they have any, of course, they didn't know what was going to happen, but did they have any sense of how much this case had affected him personally, do you think?
I don't know if it was apparent to anyone in particular at that moment how heavy a toll it was taking. Mm-hmm. But I do know that as the case had progressed, people very close to him and people, mutual close friends, as well as Aaron's father, who I was in regular contact with at the time, were deeply concerned, and that Aaron himself was deeply concerned. And he, so much so, that Aaron had sent me an email late this summer when I was pushing him to be active in his own defense and in the fundraising. And he wrote me an email saying just that it was so difficult for him to even think about it. That it was really clear that it was so extraordinarily burdensome to him that, you know, it, as a defense mechanism almost, he had to not think about it as much as possible and just move forward with life and be proactively working.
So you could see the toll this was taking on him yourself.
I could. I mean, it was not obvious in the sense that he was not being social or not surrounded by friends and loved ones. You know, he had spent Thanksgiving with us and you know, we had seen him just after Christmas and, you know, he seemed okay and, you know, a little bit maybe subdued, you know, mm-hmm. when I asked him sort of how he was holding up. But you know, he was spending time with people. He was working. He, you know, at the service yesterday, his partner with whom he lived in New York, you know, sort of said even that morning, you know, they had had a great morning. Mm-hmm. And he had said, you know, just that day that he or earlier that after New Year's, he had told her that he thought 2013 was going to be a good year, and he felt like things were possible. And then Wednesday of last week, there was the final plea negotiation.
Right. So let's back up for just a minute, and I wonder, you know, I think so many people now have heard of Aaron Swartz who hadn't before. In your view, what was it that he really contributed? You know, what would you want to remember him for doing in terms of contributing to the internet and to sort of the digital world?
What was particularly amazing about Aaron was that not only was he an amazing programming prodigy and sort of internet prodigy author and activist, but that he really regarded his role in life as being far beyond that and as being really much more about humanity in general. And so when he realized sort of what was happening with the internet and with controls of the internet and the threats to net neutrality and freedom of information, which I think he regarded as really essential to spreading information in order to enable better lives for everybody in the world and not only sort of the privileged few who had access to that information. He really set about making systemic change and started working politically and as a political activist. And you know, we worked, he was a board member at Change Congress, and he worked at the Ethics Center at Harvard on institutional corruption issues and started Demand Progress. And, you know, he was really, really sort of active on all possible fronts and had his sights set perpetually onward. And what was so striking yesterday at the funeral was that many of his collaborators spoke at length about his relentless pursuit of more solutions and more work and you know, sort of how to confront, you know, the deepest problems and the biggest barriers. And I think that that will be what we most have lost, is somebody who was really just pushing farther and harder and thinking more and beyond.
And it sounds, too, like he could have chosen a much more financially rewarding path, given how smart he was and how much he contributed. I mean, essentially creating RSS.
Absolutely. I mean, he could have done anything. He could have been a billionaire. He could have, you know, written his own ticket. And the ticket that he chose to write was to do as much good as he possibly could.
Why? I mean, why do you think he made that choice rather than the choice of sort of cashing in and making a lot of money, not to denigrate the people who do those things, but why did he make the choice he made in terms of, like you said, trying to change Congress, really trying to make information free in the way that he believed it should be?
Because he was an idealist,
yeah,
through and through. That was who he was at his core. You know, he was known among his friends for conversations that would last, you know, half a day or longer, you know, and where he would just push. And these were people who were doing, you know, idealistic work as well. And, you know, he would just push for how it could be done better and more effectively and to improve more lives and reach farther. His father at the service yesterday mentioned that his own father, Aaron's grandfather, had been awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for work he had done. Right. And that he felt that that had profoundly shaped Aaron's outlook on life. And he talked a lot about Aaron's early life and how precocious he had been and how he had taught himself to read at three and, you know, was inventing ATM machines in elementary school for projects and, you know, started at Stanford at 16 and then chose to quit because he felt no one else was taking it seriously. And he, you know, he just had a huge capacity for life, for information, for hope, for optimism, you know, and he was known sort of among his collaborators and people who he sought out to work with who were his mentors, but who also regarded him as their mentor, because he nothing was ever enough, because he could always imagine what more could be done and what the next step would be.
Now, we've seen in the last couple of days, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner say, look, I think that prosecutors went after Aaron Swartz too hard for what he did. But I wonder, did you ever think or did you ever talk to him about the idea of, well, you know, liberating knowledge is good, but look, I mean, in the case of what he did, which was liberating or downloading, illegally downloading all these articles from JSTOR, These are articles that, you know, journals work on, academic journals work on, right? And you have to pay people to maybe evaluate them and to put together the journal. And so what if there's money involved? You know, maybe these things can't quite be sold for free because it takes money to produce. Did you ever have those kinds of conversations?
I did not have those conversations with Aaron, and I was not advising him on the substance of the case. And I'm not an expert in that area of the law. There are a lot of people who have written very articulately, including Tim Wu and my husband, Lawrence Lessig, pieces that you can find online that really sort of explain the nature of what Aaron did and put it into context. And the law that he was accused of violating was something that was very vaguely drafted. And Representative Zolofgren proposed yesterday an amendment to that law that she proposes calling Aaron's Law, which would radically limit, or not radically limit, but would really reduce the vagueness so that it would not extend to the sort of thing that Aaron was doing, which could actually be grouped sort of along with millions of other trivial terms of service violations, which occur every day by everyday internet users. And I think the framework to sort of view this prosecution in is really as happening during a period when WikiLeaks was a concern, cybercrime was a concern, people were looking for an example. Mm-hmm. And specifically, the prosecutors were looking for a sample, like an example that they could make of someone who was a high-profile hacker.
Yeah.
And Aaron was not singled out as a person because he personally was a threat, but he was singled out because it sort of fit the bill.
As an example.
As an example. Yeah. And sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH. I'm talking with Bettina Neufeind, a lawyer who knew Aaron Swartz well, was helping to raise money for his legal defense. And let me bring into this conversation Jeff Howe, a professor at Northeastern and a contributing editor to Wired magazine. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And I know you've been listening to the conversation, and I wanna ask you the question of, do you think that the prosecutor, Carmen Ortiz, in this case, was overzealous in going after Aaron Swartz for downloading more than 4 million documents from JSTOR, which is this online academic, essentially, you know, conglomeration of journals?
That's correct. I mean, I'm worried about just being part of the chorus. Like a lot of people, I'm terribly saddened by Aaron's death. I'm terribly disturbed by the events that led up to it. It seems like prosecutorial overreach to me. Certainly, I would throw in the caveat that Ortiz probably has a big docket, and I think it was someone under her, Stephen Heyman, I think the name is, who is actually pursuing the case. It's unrealistic to think that these cases aren't going to be, that there won't be political motivations. And in some cases, we want that from our DA's offices. We want them being aggressive. Here it was a case of just as Bettina's been saying, all the stars aligned to make Aaron a poster boy in the worst sense for hacking, to show that institutions, I think, like MIT, were no longer the wild, wild west, but could stand up for the powers of property and copyright. And so I think they went after him hard, and we see the result now.
You know, we've seen Dana Boyd this week. She's a senior researcher at Microsoft. She's a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center. That she said this week, this was a power struggle, much as you're saying. And I wonder if this sounds right to you. She said, this is hackers and geeks versus national interests and information security. So sort of the security complex versus the insurgents. Does that feel right to you?
You know, it doesn't. And I read Dana's comments, and I respect Dana a lot, and I respected a lot of her thoughts there. But I really resist, you know, having spent 12 years covering technology, I really resist this Manichean tendency, or I should say like a binary tendency, there's the geeks and there's everyone else. Like, this is like gun control. Like, we have a very simple proposition, those of us who understand this, which is that stealing a car and stealing information are radically different acts, and that the law needs to recognize that they're different acts. And this isn't a geek position. This is anyone who understands the politics of information would I would think, come to this very reasonable conclusion. You know, one of Aaron's projects that no one is talking about, or very few people are talking about, was his work on the court record database. Basically, the government had made an enormous trove of data, I want to say like 100 million documents, open to the public, but they were charging 8 cents a page. Well, for someone who doesn't have access who doesn't have a lot of money to put towards their legal case, a public document that's 8 cents a page is not a public document. And in fact, the 8 cents a page was supposedly going to fund the technology that this program required. However, that program was running $150 million surplus. They didn't need to be charging 8 cents a page. And so Aaron went and downloaded 20 million of those documents, and he sent it to his collaborator, who was able to post them for free. Because you know what? Information can be free really easily in a networked age. And so that's the kind of work that Aaron was doing. I challenge you to find me someone who says that was not a just act.
Bettina Neuhofein, let me come back to you on that. You're a lawyer, and here is this question of, should we be charging for legal documents?
I think that's a very good question, and I don't know that I'm the authority to answer it, but you know, it's certainly the case that there are expenses in information processing and management, but at a certain point, the marginal cost really is gone. And there are many people who would take the position, and I think rightly so, that when something could be available for free and people are deprived of justice because they are deprived of that information, there is no good reason for it.
And it sounds like also it sort of fits into Aaron's belief system, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, what we were just talking about was the PACER documents. And, you know, there's good reason to believe that, you know, that was also a motivation for pursuing Aaron because the FBI was not able to make that case stick.
Jeff Howe, I wonder, do you think the case against him was at all just? Should it have been pursued at all, even if the stakes were lowered $1 million and 35 years in prison? Okay, maybe that was too high. But you know, you said there's a difference between stealing different kinds of things, stealing a car and stealing information, not the same thing. But does the government need to crack down on hackers who take information?
I'm all for civil disobedience, and I'm all for civil disobedience driving a change in the law, and I'm all for a society that follows its laws, and when it doesn't, breaks them in protest and accepts the consequences. Aaron broke laws, and I think the state is always in its rights to prosecute a lawbreaker. Should there be a sense of proportion? Of course. I mean, I think that's what all of us. I'm sure there are people who, don't believe that the government should have pressed its case at all. I'm not one of them. I mean, I to tell you the truth, I thought it was kind of as far as acts of civil disobedience go, I thought this was a dumb one. I would have wanted it to be much more public. The idea of him breaking into a server room and then running from a guard, it just strikes me as ill thought out. Some of the wrong laws were being broken. I mean, breaking into MIT property, that's, no one has a problem with a university's right to, keep its server room locked and secure.
Bettina Neuhofein, you're shaking your head. Let me send that to you.
It's my impression that there, because of what has happened now, that people sort of feel as though the facts are not in dispute. And I don't think that was the case at all. In fact, the expert witness who would have testified in Aaron's defense published what he would have said yesterday online, and it's available online for anyone to look at. And he really describes in detail how what Aaron did, he thinks, should be more accurately characterized as someone being inconsiderate as opposed to breaking a law, because all that he did was take up a lot of bandwidth, essentially. And, you know, he equates it to someone using a checkbook in the grocery line, you know, and delaying other people in line to pay, or checking out, 100 history books while writing a History 101 paper, and so perhaps unreasonably delaying the checkout line at the library, but that he had access to that server closet. It was not locked. The reason that the MIT police or the police came, and it was because they were monitoring it because someone else had had a pattern of stealing server equipment from the closets. And possibly the only reason that MIT, in fact, allowed this prosecution to go on was because they had requested the assistance of the police in helping them monitor the equipment in the closets. So, you know, this sort of this image of Aaron clandestinely, secretly going into this, breaking into a closet, I think there's no actual evidence of any of that having happened.
Well, and I'm perfectly willing to be, you know, to stand corrected on that front, and you know, I'm perhaps evidence that very idea was widely promulgated.
Well, I do think it really makes the point that prosecutorial discretion is an extraordinarily heavy hammer. You know, there is really a presumption of guilt that comes with it when a government comes down on someone so hard and absolutely refuses to negotiate in a sort of human way with them. And what breaks my heart about the situation was that what it really all hinged on was that Aaron was not willing to be labeled a felon because he felt that he had not done anything wrong. You know, and he held himself to an extremely high standard. He held everybody who he loved and worked with to an extraordinarily high standard of justice and rightness. And you know, the idea that he should live for the rest of his life labeled as a felon and having people believe that he was a criminal when what he stood for was justice was just really impossible for him to accept.
And again, I think that brings us back to what I talked to you about at the very beginning, sort of his father feeling like it was the government that pushed him and that he was hounded by the government in his last days. Jeff Howe, one final question to you. Where do you think that this case and the discussion around it goes from here?
Well, hopefully, I mean, I love Dana's, you know, it's Dana Boyd in Wired, Dana's headline, which is, you know, we need laws, not martyrs. So I hope that Lofgren's legislation is taken seriously. I find it fascinating and a little troubling that Daniel Issa is in our court on this. But you know what? If that's our strange bedfellow, I'll take him. He carries a lot of weight. If this can be made bipartisan and we can begin introducing as Bettina has been saying, as much of the consensus is forming some sense of proportion in our laws concerning information, then I hate language like it will be a fitting tribute to Aaron's death, because there is no fitting tribute for someone's death, especially someone young, idealistic, one of our most brilliant contributors to technology in the last 20 years. But you know, I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it.
And we're going to be following this case, the laws that come from it, the story of Aaron Swartz, which sort of continues on in discussions on shows like this and online. I've been speaking with Bettina Nieuwenfeind, a social justice lawyer who is helping to raise money for Aaron Swartz's defense fund. Bettina Nieuwenfeind, thank you so much for coming in and talking about this tough subject.
Thank you for having me.
And Jeff Howe, professor at Northeastern and contributing editor at Wired Magazine. Jeff, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm Kara Miller, and this is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.